My guest on Dan Really Likes Wine this week is no stranger to the show whatsoever. He holds the Guinness World Record for most free wine lunches attended in one day. There's not a South African wine he does not know back to front. And from an ignominious beginning in the finance world, he's found his true calling in the world of wine and is now one of the world's foremost authorities on wine in general, but particularly South African wine, which he champions from his 8-story penthouse in Richmond. Gives me great pleasure to welcome onto the show Lord Greg Sherwood.
Thanks, Dan. It's always wonderful to your introductions get better every time.
Well, they deserve to, because it's not just wonderful to have you on the show, but you are a great champion of South African wine. And I often wonder, in fact, when we were sitting over lunch with our mutual friends at Bellevue yesterday at the Potluck Club, I was thinking, watching you scribble away one of your 17-page tasting notes, if you do ever stop and wonder about that sliding doors moment, and if Greg, the finance type, had continued and you hadn't decided that, no, there is a greater calling and that wine was actually where you needed to be.
Well, I was just chatting to someone earlier and they said, oh, how did you get into this? I said, well, commodity trading, you know, trading widgets, but I think dealing with wine, and it's a much more interesting product. So I was thrilled to, I actually studied wine as an escape, as a kind of to downtime, and really just absolutely fell head over heels. It has everything I love. It's got history, it's got geography, it's got the social side, and it's got incredible stories and meeting people, which basically ticks all my boxes. So, I mean, if somebody had told me that the wine trade existed out there 20 years earlier, I would have done it earlier. So I lost a bit of time, but I've made up for it. So I'm pretty much been just over 25 years now, almost 30 years in the wine trade, most of that in London, but it's been, yeah, fantastic, and really enjoyed it.
I still remember not the look on her face, because it was a telephone call, but the sound in my mother's voice when I called her 20 odd years ago and told her I'd resigned from my job as a sports editor and resigned from my job as a radio presenter because I was going to go and MC events, which she thought was ludicrous and couldn't possibly be a real job. And it was a bit of a vote of faith in myself and a leap of faith to be able to do that. How much was it for you?
I kind of knew I wanted to. It was obviously a massive thing to, obviously having studied business economics and kind of marketing and having worked in finance and then as a commodity trader later, you know, just totally changing careers is a massive step. But I've always had a passion for business. I've always had a passion for the workings of industry. And I was, you know, very interested in the kind of mechanics of the wine trade, or from producer level all the way up to merchant level. So I was always going to be in the business of wine. I specifically wanted to be top end of the trade, the pinnacle, the 1% fine wine kind of side of it, because I do believe that, you know, those are where some of the greatest stories and the history comes from. And it is very much, wine is a trickle-down effect. I know people sometimes poo-poo the fine wine industry in the top end because maybe they've worked more in an FMCG environment or on bigger estates or big brands or supermarkets or things. But I think there's no such thing. I've got to get Jamie Good. I'll get a slap from him, because as he's always telling people, there's no such thing as the wine, you know, the industry, the trade, or the consumer. They are. It's made up of multifaceted segments and layers and different categories. There is no one thing as the wine trade. You know, it's a real puzzle of many, many pieces. And I'm thrilled to be able to have worked for as long as I have in the top end of the trade, over 20 years as a fine wine buyer. And now using my expertise, my experience, my contacts, my knowledge, and any influence I may or may not have to really champion writing about wines, telling producers' stories, writing, reviewing, and just really kind of digging a bit deeper, which, you know, you can only go so far as a wine buyer. But now doing more media and more writing and more journalism work, I'm really enjoying it. Yeah, it's a good next stage from 25 years of kind of grafting in the wine trade. So
I remember standing with a barefoot Duncan Savage, so he was dressed up clearly in his Salt River Empire, and your name came up, and I remember him just looking into a non-existent horizon and saying, "Geez, Greg Sherwood, that guy can write a tasting note." And I think that's become something of a signature. You write beautifully, but your way of evoking something beyond just what is in the glass is so powerful.
Yeah, look, I mean, everyone has their styles. I don't know if it's comes down to my personality or whatever, but what I want people when they read my note is initially I thought, if they can read it and close their eyes after they've read it and think that they've almost tasted the wine by reading the note. So you want to be a bit floral. You want to have a bit of, as Michael Frijon calls my notes, purple prose puffery. I'm still working on the t-shirts. I've promised him the first one. But I love that.
It from you and give it to
there him. Has to be a certain amount of poetry and prose, but I think you also need to, there is a serious side to that I like to, that certainly on the fine wine side, people want to know is, you know, about the structure of the wine, the acidity of the wine, the real kind of the texture of the wine, the balance. And I think it's hard to do that with, you know, a quick spit in a spurl. You know, you do need to give the wines thought. And I often, when I am reviewing some quite serious wines, often we'll taste them over 2 or 3 days and see how they evolve. The notes don't always change that much, but I try and get a real understanding of the wine and kind of try and understand what the winemaker was doing and just give that little bit of extra thought and depth. And hopefully that comes out in my notes. So it's not, they're not meant to be contrived, or it's just, you know, I'm trying to, maybe it's the way I studied, it just a layered approach to, you know, describing a wine. And you know, when you're tasting some great wines, fine wines, you know, there's just so much going on. And I can't just stick with a bit of fruit and a bit of, you know, I've got to dig deeper and try not to be pretentious, you know, with descriptions, and try and make the flavors and smells and fragrances relatable to, look, not necessarily just the man in the street, but certainly to people who enjoy fine wine and are willing to dig deeper and want that greater engagement with fine wine. And that's part of the whole fine wine industry and premium wines. And your mom didn't complain when she joined us for lunch and we were drinking Rousseau Clos Saint-Jacques there. So I'm sure she was quite happy you changed careers.
Very happy indeed. In fact, I think all of the family around us are happy because we both benefit, amongst other things, from getting vast amounts of wine delivered for research purposes, of course.
Indeed.
You far more than me, and you get beyond just the South African, you're getting wine delivered from all over the world. There is so much of it, which leads to a couple of questions for somebody in the unique position that you are. Particularly with the writing, I write far less than you do, but I will be sitting there thinking, how do I talk about a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc without saying something I've said 100 times before? Because there are those broad evocations that a varietal will have. Do you ever sit there going, geez, where's my thesaurus? How can I come up with something new to say about Rioja?
Look, I mean, you do sometimes go to a tasting, and look, I've got to go after this to the Cabernet Collective 2024 tasting. I've got about 35 wines to taste and review, and you need to look deep into the wines because they all should be and will be different, even though they're all from the same vintage and pure Cabernets. But if you're tasting 30 Marlborough Sauvignons from New Zealand, you know, you've got to have your thesaurus at hand. But I think it's how quick the descriptives and the feel, the whether it's texture, flavors, fragrance, you know, there's lots of things you can talk about wine, and then you get, and if you realize it is a great wine or good wine, well-made wine, or if it's just a commercially good everyday wine, you can, there's always something you can, there's always a hook you can hang your hat on and kind of describe in the wine. But I think for writing notes, I mean, I kind of like to write notes about wines and to write about wines because you can't drink wine all the time. It's a bit. It's good to also then have more of a kind of bit of academia to it, which I quite enjoy as well.
I remember back, I've mentioned this on the show a few times before, being at a wine event with the great Vikas Huyman, one of the modern greats of the sommelier world, who's got a ridiculous nose. And he'd opened a bottle of wine, poured it, had a sip, looked at me and deadpanned, "This is a freshly opened can of tennis balls." You absolute git. I'm not falling for this. You're pretentious, Wally. You're just trying to come up with something that And then I took the nose, and it was a fresh can of pretzels.
That's a good note, and it's not a pretentious note. I think most consumers know that smell.
Exactly.
Or like the smell of a fresh Lilo, that kind of lanolin, or you get on some kind of young Samuels.
And that's what it is. It's not exactly what it smells like, but it strikes a chord in someone's head. Ah, I know where you are. It might not be the exact house on the street, but it gives me the street, and it pushes me in that direction to work out where
I am. But what I love about wine is, you know, a lot of kind of people say, well, I just drink it. I said, well, all you need to know about wine is what you like and what you don't like. That's all you need to know. And if you want to go a little bit further, people say, oh, but I can't. How do you get all these descriptives? And I said, well, everyone, pretty much most people can do it. And I said, well, do you smell this or that? And they're like, yeah, I get that. And I said, well, it's just about training your brain and your mouth to kind of put the word to the descriptives. And it comes more and more naturally without being, you don't want it to be automatic where you're shotgunning things that actually aren't there to make up a note. But I think it's just having that quick identification. And I think the more people taste and smell wines as opposed to just drinking them, everyone enjoys wine a lot more, you know, especially fine wine.
Tell me about that wines. Filing cabinet in your head that allows you to drink a glass of wine and go, ah, yes, that reminds me of that second label Super Tuscan I had with Alan Lamb at 3 a.m. at a pub in Fulham that we found at the bottom end of a wine list. How do you remember as many wines and their qualities as you do, given that, as I've noticed today, 17 different people came up and said, hello, Greg Sherwood, and you could remember one of them. Now, yes, you meet a million people, but you do have this ability somehow to remember wine.
Well, I'm lucky I can remember things. I guess it's somewhere in your brain, there's the hooks that you hang it on, and I've developed a natural process through decades of hanging things on those hooks. But as you say, I feel terrible walking around a show, and I know everyone, some people for many, many years, and I just can't remember their names. That's terrible. And I was to say, when it comes to learning about, because I love kind of digging into, you know, talking about cheeses of the world or cold, you know, cured meats or whiskies or something. But literally, my filing cabinet's not closing anymore. The papers are coming out, and I just haven't got space to. I'd love to kind of learn all the intricacies of, you know, the kind of cheese industry and cheeses from around the world, from goats and milk, you know, cow milk. I just can't. I can never remember any of this stuff. But I'll stick to wine, and I think, you know, I hang those things on the right hook, and I can always remember the wines I drank 20 years ago, but I can forget someone's name I met 5 minutes ago. But it's one of those funny ones, though.
I did hear you proudly telling your wife on the phone that you're about to do Dave Really Likes Wine. So we'll forgive you for that, because you give us great wine content and great stories, and can give us a very up-to-date picture on South African wine in the UK. Few people know this space better from both a trade perspective and also a journalist's perspective. The broad view is that the days of South African wine existing solely at the bottom shelf of the supermarket are behind us, although there is still a fair amount of wine in that space, and that there is a greater appreciation for South African wine in that middle and upper tier wine that can compete with the better wines of the established wine world. But how far up that ladder have we gone? Should we be happy with where we are, or is there still more work to be done?
Look, I mean, a lot's changed over the 25 plus years I've been back in the UK, and I mean, I'm not going to labor the point, the wine industry around the world is changing. It's there's a lot of wine being made that's going to need to find a home, but I can tell you, for all its trials and tribulations in the fine wine trade and in the just general trade, and evolve and new consumers coming on and new generations, older generations drinking less or stopping, a lot of older generations having a lot of wine in their cellars and not really kind of going for that extra engagement, there's a new consumer and the industry is changing. But, you know, I like to tell the story, you know, about how sherry fell out of favor, and because it was something your grandmother would give the vicar, you know, and obviously that's not very cool and young. But, you know, a generation is what, 20, 25 years, and the new generation of drinkers fell in love with weekends away in Barcelona or to Jerez, and sitting in wine bars, eating a bowl of all nuts and olives and drinking Fino sherry and or Oloroso sherry, and it became really cool again. And they were opening sherry bars in London, in Barcelona, in Madrid, you know, all over Europe. I mean, it became really cool again. But it does take that kind of culture change. And what we've seen now is South African wine became very cool and is great, but it's being passed very comfortably onto the next generation, which doesn't happen automatically. I mean, I think countries like Chile have got problems. The baton hasn't been passed on to a new generation of drinkers. Australia are doing very well to make sure that it is passed on, and they're making incredible wines. But South African, the new generation love South African wine. They love going to Cape Town. They love our tourism industry. It helps that we've got 4 World Cups in the rugby.
And Bursley, France, New Zealand, Australia, England, Wales, Italy, Ireland.
But, you know, so there's so many aspects that feed into our cultural gift that we can pass on to new generation of drinkers. And we heard a great speech from Mr. Steenhuisen opening the show, and he touched on some really kind of warming things of what being South African is, what it means when people meet South Africans, whether and what they come away with. And I think, you know, wine is the perfect vehicle for that. And we've got so many things that we are passing on to a new generation of drinkers. And South African wine is staying very cool, very topical. The quality has never been better. Yes, there are more premium wines out there, but they're great, and they're getting a bit more expensive, which they should, because they, you know, those wines aren't easy to make or cheap to make. But we've got a fantastic place in the wine industry. And I mean, we've been doing interviews and talking for many years, and you often ask, you know, how's the trade? But I can tell you now, the top fine wine merchants and brokers and stuff are really getting engaged in the South African category. Companies like Border Index have really gone big for things like the Cape Winemakers Guild wines, which is great because they like the exclusivity, they like the niche of it, they like the quality of it, and they're not everywhere, and it's very finite. But just general, our premium category, all merchants, all importers, retailers, they all feel it's a necessity to have a good South African range, and if they're an importer, kind of to have certain agencies. Whereas in the past, people said, no, we'll just do a bit of French or a bit of Spanish. But now everyone says, look, if we've got to have some good South African stuff. It's so integral to the wider fine wine trade, not just in UK, but across Europe actually now. And obviously a lot of Europe are producing nations, and the UK is now too. But I know a lot of all my friends in Bordeaux and Burgundy, they love drinking good South African wines, whether that's Cinsos or Grenaches or even Pinotage or Alpine Chenins. I mean, we've got great wines, and they love to buy them. They love to drink them and share them and taste them alongside, you know, kind of their local wines. So it's great.
Tell me a bit about Bordeaux and Burgundy in the UK at the moment, because from afar, both spaces seem to have their challenge. On the Burgundy side, more and more people just not able to access the wine given the price points, which are increasingly out of range for those who aren't the Sherwoods of the world. And then Bordeaux, through things like climate change, having to drop prices. We've seen one big producer step away from the Bordeaux classification because they feel that's what they need to do to be able to adapt to this current world. I don't like seeing that, because I want great Burgundy and great Bordeaux to flourish. But that said, it does suggest that South Africa perhaps does have another opportunity there, with a gap opening up in the market with people who, for one reason or another, are no longer accessing or interacting with some of the more established wines of the world.
Well, undoubtedly, it's very, very handy that South Africa is one of our strongest categories is Cabernet and Bordeaux blends. I mean, Stellenbosch, the kingdom of Cabernet, and we make some incredible Bordeaux blends, Stout blends, Capes Bordeaux blends. And they are really finding niches in the UK for people that just have either decided they don't want to, or they just can't afford to be drinking these, you know, Bordeaux wines that have... And I love Bordeaux wines, but they have kind of priced themselves out the market a little bit. And the problem is they kind of thought that they make Burgundy amounts of wine, but they don't. Bordeaux makes a lot of wine. So Burgundy makes a small amount of wine, so they have their own issues. But there is a lot of Bordeaux made, and I think just too much of it became too expensive, and they've slightly lost the next generation. And where we've stepped in, what we've been talking about, that next generation of consumers have really embraced South African fine wine. And, you know, it's not necessarily a one in, one out, but we're stepping into shoes that were once very much firmly in classical fine wine regions of Bordeaux and Burgundy. And I think on the Burgundy side, they're going to have, you know, this just very expensive, and people just don't drink the wines. So how do you pass that knowledge, that passion, that joy, the collectability, how do you pass that on it if you don't ever taste the wines and drink the wines? So things like Cinsault from Supremium, Albine Cinsaults and Grenache and even our Pinot Noirs have definitely stepped into that space at multiple segments of consumer. And, you know, quite rightly, we are not the best country at producing bulk wine and selling it for kind of £1, you know. We've got a lot of kind of cost structures in this country. And to be sustainable and to be quality and to look after your workers and to look after your, you know, and be responsible, you know, you shouldn't, you know, we should never be focusing on that real bottom end. But there is a place for well-made, you know, commercial volume. And if we can do it and make a little bit of money, some of the bigger producers, that's great. But there's, our niche is the kind of storied, interesting middle market where people have a more, maybe not very high, but they have more engagement in wine. And, you know, we're absolutely killing it there.
So quality wine from a great area of production with a cool story to it and a bit of heritage. That leads us rather nicely to the bottle of Pinotage that we have in front of us. And you and I were sharing some of this yesterday over, it started as a breakfast, it turned into a lunch, and it almost became a dinner, which tends to happen with you, Sherwood. You're a very bad influence, but a very happy one to spend time with. This is some Bellevue Pinotage, and I think we would be in agreement in that Pinotage is in a pretty happy place at the moment for a grape that had a lot of bad PR for a long while, but I think also had a bit of an identity crisis. I wasn't always sure what it was. It came from parents who were a rhythmic gymnast and a ballerina, and they gave birth to a nightclub bouncer, and it was just all very odd and uncertain. And now the finesse and the elegance, which I think Pinotage has always had the potential to show, is coming through in so many of our star Pinotages, and Bellevue an exact example thereof.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic tasting yesterday, done blind, which was great because then you have to kind of think about the wines very carefully. But, you know, 100th anniversary of Pinotage this year. I mean, I've been fortunate to have lots of dinners and celebrations and tastings with key players, and it's been great. But, you know, I've not had one bad Pinotage at all these events, and they're not all super premium. They've been some quite kind of good middle ground Pinotage, and they've all been great. They've all got their own character, but they've all got lovely balance, lovely harmony, and lovely freshness to them. And we've certainly kind of perfected that kind of what we think Pinotage should be. And they're not all the same. And this is great, you know. And I love the Bellevue story is quite a kind of strike. It touches me because it's one of these old historical estates that kind of lost their way a little bit and fell by the wayside a bit in the onslaught of the young guns, you know, and Swatland. And I just love that in Stellenbosch and around Stellenbosch and some of the older, you know, regions, wards like Constantia stuff, there are these older estates that are being rejuvenated and regenerated and are making incredibly exciting wines again with older winemaker. Wilhelm, the winemaker, has been there 25 years. And as he says, he's 25 years older, but then so were the vines. So they've got a very high average age of vines. They've also got, obviously, their 1952 and 1953 kind of Cinsault and Pinotage vineyards, which are very historical. One of the five oldest in the country. So I think this, you know, it's producers like this which are making a wine that people really enjoy. You know, the older consumer might say, oh, no, don't drink Pinotage. But as I think we discussed yesterday, if you do a blind tasting, I can guarantee you that one of their favorite wines will be the Pinotage. And certainly at the kind of at this level, like a reserve level.
And Pinotage perceptions in the UK?
Yeah, well, it's that whole kind of sherry thing again. You know, it took a generation to get rid of the the stereotypes and cliches, and the new generation love it. They drink it on holiday. When they come to the Cape, they buy it in, they bring, come back to the UK, or they buy it from, you know, from wine shops. They're getting more involved in the story, the history, the anniversary, the 100, you know, the culture, the history of it. And the wines are really, really good. And they don't taste like Shiraz or Cabernet or something else. They've got their own, they've got their own character, and people really like it. And if they're well made, it's a great wine. And it's you know, people always said we should never have hung our calling card for South Africa on Pinotage variety, but I think now we make so many good ones, and the wines are have such character and finesse that you know, can't do any harm to. And the new generation of kind of millennials and kind of, you know, younger Gen Zs, you know, that they have no hang-ups about Pinotage, and they certainly don't know what burnt rubber is. Thank goodness.
It basically just needed hip, cool, cutting-edge young types like you and me with our Toctic accounts and our influencer space to get the kids drinking it all.
Absolutely. You know, it's just it's that generational thing. And sometimes if you fall on the wrong side of a of the messaging, of the fame, and of the, you know, you might have to wait and do a lot of marketing to turn the clock around. But luckily, as I say, for South African categories, Pinotage is riding the wave along with the whole success of South Africa and the whole wine category. And we're just leading with so many kind of varieties. I mean, not just Pinotage, I mean, which is homegrown, but like, you know, we look at Chenin Blanc. I mean, people forget that how much Chenin Blanc is grown in the Loire, but that, you know, people hardly talk about it. You know, South Africa has just totally owned that space.
And heading there with Chardonnay and Cap d'Asie.
Absolutely. And they're chipping away at, you know, Pinot Noir gets better and better. We've still got a ways to go, but we've got some great ones now. Chardonnays are fantastic. I feel we're just about now, after 10, 15 years, have breaking the glass ceiling of the Chardonnay quality, and we're pushing with scores and quality, and ratings now are going a bit higher again because we're getting some really kind of intricate styles. And I think quite a bit of that has been down to the work a lot of the producers have done at CWG level, where they've kind of drilled down, focused on real quality, and then it's almost like Formula One, kind of using that, what you've learned there, to put it into your kind of saloon car. You know, it's very much that, and I feel that's what the fine wine industry does for the wider industry. And I don't think there's anything that people lower down should be, you know, worried about, and people at the top certainly shouldn't be snooty about, you know, more commercial wines, because it's all a continuum for the consumer, and everything finds its kind of customer segment. So, but South African wine is just, we're very, very lucky that there's so much positivity around the product, around the brand, around the quality, around the value for money, that many of them still very much do over-deliver, and that so many classical wine regions around the world have just unfortunately become very, very expensive and fallen into a bit of a trap of losing the next generation. So I think we need to exploit it further. I think it's a great message, you know, for people to do. And we make so many different styles of wine. So, and so people like the classics, there's something for everyone. So I love that.
And it could be the extent of our wine drinking experience, and we'd be very satisfied for it. But I'm a big advocate for going beyond South Africa to set our wine against a great Burgundy or a great Bordeaux, but also wine from other parts of the world, see who is doing what. You get truckloads of wine arrive on a daily basis at Chateau Sherwood. What from the rest of the world has crossed your desk of late? What's exciting you from other parts of the wine world?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was always very, you know, even doing my MW when I finished, I didn't want to be just Mr. South Africa. You know, I wanted to be recognized that having an understanding of the global trade of fine wine regions around the world, and have respect and for those, that broad expertise. So that includes Bordeaux, Burgundy, California, you know. But I would say, however much we love drinking great Bordeaux and Burgundy, I do love like some good Californian wine. I do really, it does kind of get me excited.
Is Californian wine becoming a little softer and gentler?
Well, they do have global warming problems, I can tell you. So when they get a slightly cooler year, they are very thankful. certainly 2020 and around then, they had a lot of very warm years and the kind of fire years. But I can tell you for excitement, you know, because I can say Australian wine are really, really fighting hard and working hard to make cooler, fresher, more elegant styles. And I think, and they're really promoting the whole regionality, which we've obviously been doing forever. And we realize that that is the route to great success. Whereas Australia kind of stuck a bit too long with just brand Australia, sunshine in a bottle. And they, powers that be, try to promote more regionality for the West and Australia, and, you know, Melbourne, you know, because it's there's so much diversity there, and they're doing that now, and the wine styles are very, very good. And I just see, you might say, what choice do they have? They've got to make it work, but that they're really enjoying their wine again. They're making great wine. I'm drinking more Australian wine again in London, along with lots of South African wine, and I'm really enjoying it. They've found a new freshness, a classicism, and they're quite proud of that now. And global warming will affect all wine regions. I think we have a bit of tempering here with our cooling seas, but water's a big problem here, as it is in Australia too. But I've had a lot of great Australian wines, and I was just before I flew out to the Cape, I was tasting some wonderful wines from Penfold, Grange, and Jimberry, Omar, Yalumba, just fantastic new wines, which are actually being distributed through, as I say, beyond Bordeaux, so by the negotiants, to try and diversify their portfolios of fine wine beyond just Bordeaux. So a lot of exciting things. And those producers, yeah, they're kind of tapping into new markets through those, you know, negotiant structures, which have big tendrils around the world for distribution. And even South African wine, Vendor Constance, has had a great success going through those channels. I know Canoncourt Black Label, which we drank yesterday, has been seen in the kind of negotiant plus kind of category. So is a lot of great wine, and I'm very fortunate that I can benchmark our wines, because I always get a bit annoyed when people maybe poo-poo South African top wines and say, well, what are they coming? How well do they know our wines, or what are they comparing? I drink some of the best wines from around the world. I know what they taste like, and I drink our wines, and I think I'm qualified to judge and say, well, I think we're doing pretty good comparatively. So, and when I say I think, well, that South African wine is really world-class and great, I think, you know, it's true, and, you know, because I'm comparing like for like, you know.
So if anyone is qualified to make that assessment, it is certainly you, Greg. So we'll take that very happily. I leave you with a final question, and I take you back to that filing cabinet of wine in your head, and I set a scene for you. Louis's just been named man of the match. He's won a game for London Welsh. You're a proud dad. You've had your 6 pints of London Pride. Yeah, you've updated social media, and you've got home. There is a splendid dinner in celebration of a wonderful day, and you've got bubbles, a white wine, and a red wine with which to wash down a dinner of your choice. What is the dinner? And then what, from all the wine you've had over the years, what is that bottle of bubbles? What is that bottle of white wine? What is that bottle of red wine that, if you could close your eyes and time travel back, you'd pour yourself another glass of in an instant?
Well, not to sound like a setup, but the bubbles would probably have to be something like Salon, which we again drank together last year with our good friend Mr. Kilpin, and
that was a sense.
And Mr. Brevera Ratz was there, and he had never had it before. And I just love people drinking wines.
He had a single tear come down his cheek as he drank that.
There was a lot going through his mind, and he really enjoyed it. And I thought it was fantastic to see somebody tasting something of that quality for the first time, because you kind of almost can live vicariously again through their enjoyment of it. That was so great champagne. I do love a good premium champagne. And funny enough, yes, they're expensive, but actually maybe those top ones are worth it. White wine, when I moved to the UK 25 years ago, I was like, well, when in Rome, I just wanted to drink foreign wines, you know, just full immersion. And then slowly, year after year after year, I started drinking more and more and more South African wine. Whereas I was always tasting it, buying it, writing about it. I didn't actually drink that much of it. And then actually then started every year drinking more and more. And I just think a great Chenin Blanc, and there can be none better than Ian Ordier's 2013 Old Vine Chenin Blanc that I still have three cases of, I think, and is still drinking beautifully.
You could buy a small country if you sold those.
That's a fantastic wine, and we used to call it the Cosh Dury of Chenin, and we've had a few bottles recently from another case, and it's still drinking beautifully. So that would certainly be up there with my top whites. And on the reds, you know, it may sound a bit like a cliche, but it was quite formative in my early wine career when I was still in South Africa before I moved to the UK, working in as a commodities trader in Johannesburg, and buying and drinking Cordoba Crescendo 1995.
Sure.
Sadly, I have, I think, now only one bottle left, which I'm sure Skulk Willem Duvet would love to get his hands on. But I said I'll maybe share it with him as opposed to giving it to him or selling it to him. But we can drink it together one day. That's just a simply incredible wine. That kind of defies age and defies maturation. It just seems to go on and on and on. And that's a character, a true fine wine character that you will perhaps see on Mouton Rothschild 82, which just, every time you have it, it's great. And it's 100-point kind of thing. Sasakai 85, it's just every time you have it, it's great. And I think we'll look back on wines like that Cordoba Crescendo from Chris Keat and say, yeah, they got something right there.
I love the fact that you're setting this iconic South African wine in such esteemed global company.
Absolutely.
And I know, because I know you're not just saying that. I know that is where it deserves to be. And I think that is a dinner I might be free for. So you just let me know when Louis won that game of rugby and I shall be...
I will get a date in the diary.
Greg, it is always really special to have you on the show and to share memories with you. We've had more than our fair share of glasses, and I sincerely hope there are many, many more to come.
Absolutely.
But far more important than our own shared indulgence is the extraordinary work you do in championing South African wine and in giving us such a wonderful voice for wine in the UK. So keep doing that. Keep it up. But make sure you keep visiting, because we do love having you back at home as well.
Absolutely. You know, it's fantastic to come to the Cape. I've been very fortunate this year. I've been very busy. I've had a lot of judging and a lot of visits. So this is my third or fourth visit this year already. So I'm absolutely loving it. The Cape is as beautiful as ever. I spent most of July in the Cape and in the middle of winter, which is great. I love seasons. So it's great for drinking a bit of, cracking out those port bottles and fortifieds and muscadels and all those slightly bigger, richer red wines. So I've really enjoyed being in the winter, because normally we were coming in the summer, but it's been fantastic. And it's just great to share that, because I know how great the wines, how fun the wines are from South Africa. It's great to see people enjoy them. And as I say, share their enjoyment of a great bottle of South African wine. And drink those bottles in the company of other great wines from around the world. And people say, well, actually, I preferred that South African wine. You know, you do that enough times and they realize actually the wines are equally as good and often better than many of the iconic greats. So we're in a good space. I think hopefully Cape Wine will really reinvigorate, certainly the South African category, for all the buyers and merchants and journalists that are here. They all seem full of energy and positive in a global context where, you know, we have challenges and the world needs to kind of reinterpret what the wine trade will look like in kind of 5, 10, 20 years time. But people are still going to be drinking wine. I think we need to set the social setting, set our stall up for people to enjoy great food, great wine, and in a real social setting. And that's what new generation of consumers want. That's what they drink. That's when they drink with their friends in a restaurant with great food around a barbecue. So that is the future of wine. That is going back to where it essentially, you know, you would meet families, friends around a table, great bottles of wine, big bowls of food. And that's where we are now. So I think that, you know, the future is positive, and I'm quite enjoying doing all my kind of more journalistic and writing and reviewing roles now. And not just in South Africa, but traveling all over Australia last year, and in Europe and America. So it's a new era for me. I'm still very much tied and enjoy the business side of wine. It's just, I love the kind of commerce of wine as an industry. So it's not just about drinking wine, but it's also about making it, buying it, you know, the whole vine to table kind of process on it. You know, I find it all fascinating. It's so I'll stick at it while I can till they force me to retire.
Other than the use of the word barbecue, that was an almost perfect conversation. Greg Sherwood, thank you. If you have been enchanted by Mr. Sherwood, and why wouldn't you, then head online to the Fine Wine Safari for more of the wine poetry for which Greg has become rightly celebrated, and get a regular fix of the man who does so much for South African wine and many others from his home in London. Joining us this week on Dan Really Likes Wine, with some insight into his own wine story and where the wine world sits from his perspective, Greg Sherwood, Master of Wine.